for they take pleasure not so much in receiving as in sharing. That is why they say the kings of the Persians not only always send out portions to their friends, commanders, and bodyguards, but also always set out the dinner of the slaves and of the dogs on their own table, so far as possible making fellow diners and fellow hearth companions of all whom they employ. For even the fiercest of beasts are tamed by a share in food. And I, laughing, said, "But that stored-away fish of the proverb, my friend, why do we not bring it out too, along with the Pythagorean measure, on which he forbade us to sit, teaching us always to leave something over from what is present for the future, and to remember tomorrow in the midst of today? Among us Boeotians, at any rate, the saying, 'Leave something also for the Medes,' is on everyone's lips, from the time when the Medes overran Phocis and the farthest parts of Boeotia, plundering and pillaging as they went. And everywhere, always, the maxim, 'Leave something also for strangers who arrive,' ought to be ready to hand. Just as I, for my part, find fault with Achilles' table, always caught empty and starved. For when the envoys around Ajax and Odysseus arrived, he, having nothing ready, is forced to cook and prepare food from scratch. And again, wishing to show Priam kindness, he leaps up and slaughters a white sheep, and skins and roasts it, spending a great part of the night on these tasks. But Eumaeus, being, as he was, the well-bred nursling of a wise man, had no such trouble when Telemachus appeared, but at once feasted him once he had sat down, setting before him platters of roasted meat, which they had left over the day before when they were eating. And if this seems a small thing, that other point is not small, the checking and holding back of appetite while the means of enjoyment is still at hand. For those accustomed to abstain from what is present desire less what is absent. Lucius then took up the point and said he recalled hearing from his grandmother that the table is sacred and that nothing sacred ought to be left empty. And it seemed to me, he said, that the table is also an image of the earth. For besides nourishing us, it is round and stable, and by some is fittingly called a hestia, a hearth. For just as we hold that the earth must always have and bear something useful for us, so too, we think the table ought not to be seen empty and left bare of anything set upon it. At the Pythian games, Callistratus, who was superintendent of the Amphictyons, when a fellow citizen and friend, a singer to the flute, arrived too late for the official registration, barred him from the competition according to the law. But in entertaining us, he brought him into the banquet dressed and garlanded, as if for a contest, adorned along with the chorus in splendid fashion. And by Zeus, at first it was a charming performance. But then, once he had shaken and rattled the company thoroughly, and perceived that most of them had given way and, carried off by pleasure, were letting him do as he pleased, playing wildly on his pipe and indulging every excess, he threw off all restraint and showed that music, more than any wine, intoxicates those who take it in however it comes, and without limit. For they were no longer content to shout and clap while reclining, but in the end most of them leapt up and joined in movements that were unbecoming of free men, though well suited to those strains and melodies. When they had stopped, and the drinking party was returning again to order, as though out of a fit of madness, Lamprias wanted to say something and speak frankly to the young men. Yet, being afraid that he might come across as too disagreeable and unpleasant, he hesitated. At that point Callistratus, as if offering him an opening, said something of this sort to lead in. "I myself," he said, "absolve the love of listening and the love of spectacle from the charge of intemperance, though I do not altogether agree with Aristoxenus, who says that the word good is applied to these pleasures alone. For people also call dishes good and perfumes good, and say they have fared well after dining pleasantly and expensively. Nor do I think Aristotle was right to excuse from the charge of intemperance the enjoyments that come through sight and hearing, on the ground that these alone are peculiar to human beings, while animals, having a nature suited to the others, both use and share in them. For we observe that many of the irrational creatures too are charmed by music, deer, for instance, by the pipe. And for mares in heat, a tune is piped which men call the horse tune. And Pindar says that the dolphin, in the windless expanse of the sea, was stirred to dance by the lovely melody of pipes. And men hunting scops owls take them by dancing, since the birds delight in the sight and, imitating the movements, sway their shoulders this way and that along with the hunters. So I see nothing peculiar to such pleasures except that they alone belong to the soul, whereas the others terminate in the body and around the body. Melody, rhythm, dance, and song, passing beyond mere sensation, lodge their charm and their tickling delight in the rejoicing part of the soul itself. That is why none of such pleasures is hidden away, nor needs darkness and encircling walls, as the Cyrenaics say. Rather, stadiums and theaters are built for them, and to watch or hear something in the company of many others is more delightful and more dignified. A mark, surely, not of intemperance and self-indulgence, but of a liberal and refined pastime, one that seeks as many witnesses of itself as possible. When Callistratus had said this, Lamprias, seeing those patrons of the entertainers growing still bolder, said, "That is not the reason, son of Leon. Rather, it seems to me that the ancients were not right to call Dionysus the child of Lethe forgetfulness, for they ought to have called him her father, since it is because of him that you two now seem to have forgotten that, of the errors people commit concerning pleasures, some are caused by intemperance and others by ignorance and inattention. Where the harm is manifest, people go wrong there through intemperance, forcing down their reasoning. But whatever does not immediately, and on the spot, exact the penalty of self-indulgence, that they choose and do out of ignorance of the harm. That is why we call those who go astray over food, sex, and drink, who are followed by many illnesses, the ruin of their fortunes, and disgrace, intemperate. Like that Theodex, who, though suffering from an eye infection, said, 'Welcome, dear light,' when his beloved appeared. Or Anaxarchus of Abdera, who, as they say, knowing full well was wretched all the same, for his nature, pleasure-struck, carried him the opposite way, a nature which most of the sophists themselves cower before. But those pleasures which, while the desires concerned with belly, private parts, taste, and smell are drawn up in opposition to them, and while people are on guard against being caught by these, steal in unnoticed around the eyes and ears and take up secret residence there, lying in ambush, those who succumb to such pleasures, though no less prone to passion and self-indulgence than the others, we do not likewise call intemperate. For it is not through knowing, but through inexperience that they are swept along, and they suppose themselves superior to pleasure if they sit through a whole day in the theaters without food or drink, as if a jar should pride itself on not being lifted up by the belly or the base, while it is easily carried off by the ears. Hence Arcesilaus said it made no difference whether one were a catamite behind or in front. One must fear the softness and self-indulgence that tickles through the eyes and through the ears no less. And one must not consider a city unconquerable merely because it keeps its other gates secure with bars, bolts, and portcullises if the enemy can get inside by passing through just one. Nor consider oneself unconquered by pleasure if one has been taken not through the shrine of Aphrodite, but through the museum or the theater. For one has equally given way and handed over one's soul to be led and carried off by pleasures. For the pleasures of every cook and perfumer, pouring over us drugs more pungent and more elaborate than those of melodies and rhythms, lead us on and corrupt us, in a way testifying against themselves. For of these there is nothing blameworthy, nor anything changed, as Pindar said of the things upon the table, whatever splendid things earth and the surging sea bring us, once they are simply set before us. But no dish, no food, and not even this excellent wine we are drinking, when consumed, has ever drawn out of us, through pleasure, such a cry as the piping and drumming just now have filled the house with, if not the whole city, with uproar, clapping, and shouting. That is why one must be especially wary of these pleasures. They are the strongest, precisely because they do not, like those concerned with taste, touch, and smell, terminate in the irrational and merely physical part of the soul, but instead lay hold of the part that judges and thinks. Moreover, against the other pleasures reason, even when it falls short in the struggle, still manages to resist, and some passions themselves often stand in the way. In the fish market, for instance, stinginess checks the gourmand's reaching hand, and love of money has turned love of a costly courtesan aside, just as in Menander, each of the drinking companions, when the pimp brought in some haughty young girl to tempt them, bent his head down and simply chewed away at his sweetmeats. For borrowing money is a harsh penalty for intemperance, and loosening one's purse strings is not at all easy. But as for these so-called liberal pleasures concerning the ears and eyes, the music-loving, pipe-loving frenzies, one may draw and enjoy them free of charge and without payment for many quarters, at contests, at theaters, at banquets, with others providing the expense. That is why corruption comes so readily to those whose reasoning does not step in to help and guide them. A silence followed, and then he said, "What then must reasoning do, or what must it say, for us to ask its help? It will hardly wrap earmuffs around us like those of Xenocrates, nor will it make us get up in the middle of dinner if we notice a lyre being tuned or a pipe starting to sound." "No, indeed," said Lamprias, "but whenever we fall in among the sirens, we must call upon the muses and take refuge on the helicon of the ancients. For a man in love with something costly cannot be brought Penelope, nor be given Panthea to live with. But a man who delights in mimes, in wretchedly composed and affectedly clever melodies and songs, can be led over instead to Euripides, Pindar, and Menander, washing his brine-soaked hearing, as Plato says, with a fresh stream of words. For just as the Magi bid those possessed by demons recite and repeat to themselves the Ephesian letters, so we too, when stirred by such warblings and leapings, by frenzied cries and head-tossing riot, ought to call to mind and set beside them those sacred and solemn letters, comparing them with songs, poems, and words held in common, so that we shall not be utterly overwhelmed by this thing, nor let ourselves be carried off sideways, as if borne along by a smooth-flowing stream. Homer represents Menelaus as coming of his own accord to the banquet Agamemnon gave for the chiefs, for he knew in his heart how his brother was toiling, and he did not overlook the fact that his brother's oversight had become obvious, nor did he reproach him by staying away, as fault-finding and difficult people do, who fasten upon such oversights and lapses of memory in their friends, taking more pleasure in being neglected than in being honored, so that they may have grounds for complaint. As for the custom of the called along, whom people nowadays call shadows, those who are not themselves invited, but are brought to the dinner by the ones who were invited, the question was raised where this custom first arose. It seemed to have begun with Socrates, who persuaded Aristodemus, though uninvited, to go with him to Agathon's house, and who then had something rather comic happen to him. For Socrates, quite unnoticed, fell behind along the way, and Aristodemus went in ahead of him. Literally, a shadow going on before a body that had the light behind it. Later, however, in receiving guests, especially those of persons in authority, it became necessary for hosts who did not know the followers and attendants accompanying the guest to extend the invitation for the guest's sake, while still setting some limit on the number, so that they might not suffer what befell the man who once entertained King Philip in the countryside. Philip arrived bringing many companions, and the dinner had not been prepared for so many. Seeing the host thrown into confusion, Philip quietly sent word around to his friends, bidding them leave room for a cake. And they, expecting this, held back from the dishes already set before them, and so the dinner proved sufficient for everyone. While I was rambling on about this to those present, Florus decided it was worth some serious inquiry into the matter of these so-called shadows, to work out whether it is proper for those invited to walk along and follow in this way. His son-in-law Caesarnius rejected the practice altogether, saying that we ought above all to follow Hesiod's advice and invite the man who loves us to the feast. Failing that, we should call upon our own acquaintances and intimates to share with us the libation, the table, the conversation that arises over wine, and the goodwill of the occasion. "As it is," he said, "we behave like those who hire out ships for freight, allowing whatever anyone brings to be loaded aboard. Just so we hand over our banquets to others and let them be filled up from whoever happens to turn up, whether they are agreeable or worthless. I would be astonished if an agreeable man ever arrived as someone else's guest, or rather uninvited, since often the host does not know him at all. And if the host does know him and is on familiar terms with him and yet has not invited him, it is all the more shameful for that man to go, as though he were being caught out for sharing in the other's hospitality in a sense by force and against the host's will. Moreover, to go ahead of or to lag behind, the man who invited him on the way to another's house carries with it a certain awkwardness, and it is hardly becoming to need witnesses on approaching one's hosts to prove that one has come to dinner not as an invited guest, but as so-and-so's shadow. And again, to tag along and keep watch over another man's time for oiling and bathing, whether he is slow or quick about it, is thoroughly illiberal and worthy of Gnatho, if indeed Gnatho became the cleverest of men at dining at others' expense. And indeed, if there is any time when people are especially permitted to say, "Tongue, if you wish to boast a little, speak freely." And the greatest frankness, mixed with playfulness, attends what is said and done over wine, how then could a man conduct himself in such company if he is not a genuine, self-invited guest, but in a sense illegitimate, smuggled into the party? For both using frankness and refraining from it toward those present lays one open to easy misconstruction. Nor is it a small evil, this casual use of names and this buffoonery, for men who are not offended but instead put up with being called shadows and answering to the name, for it accustoms one, through this readiness to be led by mere words, toward shameful conduct itself. That is why, whenever I have invited companions, I have sometimes given the name shadows, for the city's usage is strong and hard to resist. But as for myself, invited by one man to go to another's house, up to now I have held out against complying. When silence followed these words, Flora said, "This second point presents the greater difficulty, but inviting in this way is necessary in the reception of strangers, as was said before, for it is neither decent to entertain a guest without his friends, nor easy to know beforehand whom he will bring with him." And I said to him, "Consider, then, whether those who have granted hosts this manner of inviting have not also granted, to those invited, the right to comply and go along. For it is no more fine to give what ought not be given, or to ask for it, than it is to summon what ought not be summoned, or to consent to it, or to do it. Now, in dealings with rulers or with strangers, there is no choice or selection involved in the invitation. One must simply receive those who come along with them. But otherwise, when entertaining a friend, it is more friendly to invite him personally, in a way that shows one is not ignorant of his acquaintances, intimates, and kin. For the honor and the favor are greater when it is plain that one does not fail to notice which people the friend embraces most, with whom he is most glad to spend time, and that one is pleased for them to be honored equally whether invited directly or merely brought along. Not but that there are occasions when the host must act on his own judgment, just as those who sacrifice to a god together with the gods who share his altar and his temple offer a joint prayer for them, all without naming each one individually. For neither food nor wine nor perfume puts a man in so pleasant a mood as does a well-disposed and agreeable fellow guest. But to inquire closely and question what particular dishes and pastries the man about to be entertained enjoys most, and to ask about differences among wines and perfumes, is altogether vulgar and shows the manner of the newly rich. Whereas for a man who has many friends, relations, and intimates, to invite for himself those among them with whom he would most gladly spend time, and in whose company he is most cheered, and to bring these along above all, is neither unpleasant nor out of place. For neither sailing together, nor living in the same house, nor pleading a case jointly with people one does not wish to be with, is as unpleasant as dining together with them. And, conversely, dining together is as pleasant as those other things are unpleasant. For the symposium is a shared partnership in seriousness and play alike, in conversation and in action. Hence it is not chance acquaintances, but those who are truly dear to us that. And be intimate with one another, so that they may spend the time pleasantly together. Cooks prepare their dishes by blending different flavors, sharp, rich, sweet, and pungent. But a dinner party cannot become good and pleasing unless the guests brought together are of one kind and share the same feelings. Now since, as the Peripatetics say, the first mover is unmoved, while the last thing moved does not move anything else, and between the two is that which both moves other things and is itself moved by others. So too, I said, in our discussion, since there are three kinds of people, the one who only invites, the one who is only invited, and the one who both invites and is invited. We have already spoken of the one who invites. It would be no worse to go through the others as well, I said, as far as I see fit. The man, then, who is invited by another and in turn invites others is bound, I think, first of all to spare the crowd, and not, as though foraging in enemy territory, to provision himself indiscriminately from everyone around him, nor, like men seizing territory at drafts, always to block and drive off all the friends of his host in favor of his own. so that the men giving the dinner suffer what those suffer who carry out meals as offerings to Hecate and the averting gods. They do not taste them themselves, nor do the people at home, except for a share of the smoke and the commotion. For those who say, having sacrificed to the Delphians, he buys his own meat back, are merely joking with us. But this really happens to those who receive strangers who are thoughtless, or friends who arrive with a crowd of shadows, like harpies, and strip and plunder their dinners. In the next place, one ought not to go off to another man's dinner with whatever company he happens to have, but should above all invite the host's own household and intimates, competing with the host himself and forestalling him with invitations. Failing that, one should invite his own friends whom the host himself would have wished to choose, being reasonable, choosing reasonable men, and if fond of learning, choosing men fond of learning, or, if he is a man of influence, men of influence, long since seeking, in one way or another, to bring them into acquaintance and fellowship with the host. For to hand over and provide, to a man so disposed, the beginning of an association and of friendliness is a rather happy stroke, and a graceful one. But the man who brings in people uncongenial and ill-matched, heavy drinkers to a teetotaler, or dissolute and extravagant men to one plane in his way of life, or again gloomy old men, or bearded sophists with a booming voice, to a young man fond of drinking and playful, is out of season, repaying kindness with unpleasantness. For the guest who has been invited ought to be no less agreeable to his host than the host is to his guest. And he will be agreeable if he makes not only himself, but also those who come with him, and on his account both charming and gracious. As for the one who still remains of the three, the man invited by one person to go to another's house, he is one who, shrinking from the very name shadow and resenting it, will indeed seem, in truth, to be afraid of a mere shadow. Yet the matter calls for the greatest caution. For it is not right readily to follow just anyone, nor in just any manner. Rather, one must first consider who the inviter is. For if he is not a very close acquaintance, but rather one of the rich or one of the powerful, wanting, as if for a stage production, a splendid retinue, or fully persuaded that he is doing a favor and paying an honor by the invitation, he is to be declined at once. But if he is a friend and an intimate, one should not obey at once, but only if it seems that he has need of some necessary meeting and companionship that admits of no other occasion, either because he has arrived from far away after a long absence, or is about to depart, and clearly, out of good will, desires and longs to spend time together. And provided he brings along not a large or a strange company, but only himself, or himself with a few companions. Or if, apart from all this, he is working to bring about through the invitation some beginning of familiarity and friendship between the one invited and the host being a decent man and worthy of friendship. But as for worthless men, the more they lay hold and entangle themselves, the more, like brambles and cleavers, they must be stepped over. And even if the men bringing one along are decent but are not bringing one to decent company, one ought not to follow along or put up with it, as though taking a bad medicine mixed with honey, a bad friend by means of a good one. It is also out of place to go to see a person who is a complete stranger and unfamiliar, unless he is a man of outstanding virtue, as has been said, and one is doing this to make a beginning of friendship, and would be glad to arrive easily and simply in the company of another to see him. And indeed, of one's own intimates, one should go especially, when invited by another, to see those who themselves are permitted to go with others to see us. For Philip the jester thought it more laughable to come to dinner uninvited than invited. But for good men who are friends, to come uninvited to other good men who are friends is more dignified and more pleasant, if they arrive at the right moment, unlooked for and uninvited, in the company of other friends, delighting their hosts, and at the same time honoring those who brought them. But least of all is it fitting to go, when not invited by them but by others, to rulers or wealthy men or potentates, guarding, not unreasonably, against a reputation for shamelessness, bad taste, and ill-timed ambition. There was talk at Chaeronea, over wine, about entertainments, with Diogenianus of Pergamum present, and we had trouble fending off a deep-bearded sophist of the Stoa, who brought forward Plato accusing those who make use of flute girls over their wine. on the ground that they are unable to keep one another's company by means of speech. And yet Philippus of Prusa, who was present from the same wrestling school, bade us leave alone those guests at Agathon's table, who spoke things more delightful than any flute or harp. For it was no wonder that a flute girl was dismissed when those men were present, but rather it would have been strange if forgetfulness of both drink and food had not overtaken the party, through sheer pleasure and enchantment. And yet Xenophon was not ashamed, with Socrates and Antisthenes and other such men present, to bring in the jester Philippus, showing the men, as Homer showed, the onion as relish for drink. And Plato has inserted Aristophanes' speech about love, like a comedy, into the symposium, and at the end, throwing open the outer door, brings in a most colorful scene, Alcibiades drunk, crowned, and reveling. Then follow the sparring matches with Socrates and the encomium about Agathon and Socrates. O dear graces, is it lawful to say that if Apollo himself had come to that symposium with his lyre tuned, those present would have begged the god to hold off, until the discourse was brought to its conclusion and reached its end? Then can it be, he said, that those men, who possessed such grace in conversation, nevertheless made use of interludes and varied their symposia with such amusements as these, while we mix together with men of public and marketplace affairs, and often, when we happen to be so, with common and rather boorish people, banish such grace and pastime from our parties, or else leave them ourselves, fleeing as if from the approach of the sirens. Yet Clytemnestra the athlete, getting up and leaving whenever anyone brought in talk of love, was admired for it. And shall a philosopher who flees from a symposium at the sound of a flute, and when a harp girl tunes her strings, shouts for his sandals and orders the lamp lit at once, not be laughable, loathing the most harmless pleasures the way dung beetles loathe perfumes? For if ever, then surely most of all over wine, one ought to indulge in such play and give one's soul over to the god for these purposes. As for Euripides, though in other respects he is dear to me, he has certainly not persuaded me, in his prescription about music, that it should be brought in for griefs and heavy sorrows. For there, one must set over the sick, like a physician, speech that is earnest and sober, but such pleasures as these should be mixed in with Dionysus, set down as a part of play. For there is something charming in the remark of the Laconian, who, watching at Athens the contests of new tragedies, and seeing the elaborate preparations of the sponsors and the eager efforts of the trainers and the rivalry, said that the city did not seem to him to be behaving sensibly, playing with such great earnestness. For truly, when playing, one ought to play, and not purchase one's leisure at the cost of great expense or of time useful for other things, but rather, in drinking and relaxation, taste a little of such things, and at the same time, while enjoying oneself, consider whether there is anything useful to be got from them. When this had been said, as the sophist was wanting to argue back again, I headed him off, saying, "Rather, Diogenianus, one might consider this. Of the many kinds of entertainment there are, which sort would best fit a drinking party, and let us call on this wise man here to judge. For being unaffected by, and immune to the charm of, everything, he would not be led astray into choosing the more pleasant over the better." So, when both Diogenianus and the rest of us urged him, he, without hesitating at all, said that he would drive all the rest off to the stage and the orchestra, but would bring in what had recently been introduced at Rome into dinner parties, though it had not yet caught on widely. "For you know," he said, "that of Plato's dialogues some are narrative and others dramatic. Of these dramatic ones, then, the lightest are taught to boys, so that they can recite them by heart. And there is added a delivery suited to the character of the persons represented, a shaping and modulation of the voice, and gestures and expressions that follow what is being said. These things the austere and cultivated people welcomed with extraordinary delight, but the unmanly and those whose ears have been corrupted through lack of taste and culture. The sort Aristoxenus says vomit bile whenever they hear something in the enharmonic mode, rejected them. And I should not be surprised if they reject it altogether, for effeminacy is gaining the upper hand." And Philippus, seeing some of the company growing rather displeased, said, "Spare us, my good man, and be sparing in your abuse of us. For we were the first, when the practice was being introduced at Rome, to be displeased by it, and we took to task those who thought it fit to make Plato an accompaniment to wine, and to listen to Plato's dialogues over their sweets and perfumes while they drank on, at which time, with Sappho's poems and those of Anacreon being read aloud, I for my part felt I should set down my cup out of shame. But since much occurs to me to say, I am afraid I may seem to be talking to you with a certain earnestness rather than in play. And so, as you see, I hand over to my friend Diogenianus, along with the cup, the task of washing the salty ear with a draught of sweet speech. Diogenianus then took it up and said, "But I hear that these speeches too are sober ones, so that wine does not seem to be wronging us, nor to be getting the better of us. Still, I am afraid that I myself may have to submit an account of my conduct, and yet a great deal of the entertainment ought to be pared away. First, tragedy, as being not at all suited to a drinking party, but rather too solemn in its declamations, and given to contriving the portrayal of events involving suffering and lamentation. And from dancing, I dismiss the Pylaidian style, which is grand, emotional, and involves many characters. But out of respect for those praises which Socrates delivered concerning dancing, I welcome the Bathylian style, which from the outset, in its plain form, touches on the cordax, portraying some pantomime of Echo, or of a Pan or Satyr reveling together with love. Of comedies, the old comedy is unsuited to men who are drinking, on account of its unevenness. For the earnestness in its so-called parabases and its outspokenness are far too undiluted and intense, and its readiness for jibes and buffoonery is dreadfully overdone and unrestrained, and full of indecent expressions and licentious names. Further, just as at the dinners of great men each of those reclining has his own wine pourer standing by, so here each guest will need a grammarian at his side to explain each detail. Who Laespodius is in Eupolis, and who Synesias in Plato, and who Lampon in Cratinus, and each of the other people made fun of. So that our symposium would turn into a schoolroom, or else the jokes would go by unheard and unintelligible. But as for the new comedy, what objection could anyone raise? It is so thoroughly blended into symposia that one could steer the drinking party through better without wine than without Menander. For its diction is sweet, and its handling of affairs is plain and everyday, so that it is neither despised by the sober nor a source of distress to those who are drunk. And useful, unaffected maxims flow through it, and it softens the harshest of characters, as though in fire, by means of wine, and bends them toward greater gentleness. And its mixture of earnestness with play would seem to have been made for no other purpose than to provide, to men who have been drinking and are relaxed, pleasure and benefit at once. Even its love affairs, in his work, have their proper season for men who have been drinking and are about to go home shortly afterward and rest beside their own wives. For there is no love of a male boy in all those many plays, and the seductions of maidens turn, for the most part, into marriage. And the affairs with courtesans, if the women are forward and bold, are broken off through some act of self-restraint or repentance on the young men's part. But for those who are good and love in return, either some legitimate father is discovered, or some period of time is added to their love, allowing a humane show of consideration and restraint. These things, for men engaged in some other business, are perhaps worth no serious attention. But in the act of drinking, I should not be surprised if their charm and grace, together with a certain shaping and adornment, produce an effect that assimilates men's characters to those that are decent and humane. Diogenianus, then, either finished or paused and fell silent. And when the sophist attacked him again, thinking it necessary to go through certain speeches of Aristophanes as well, Philippus, addressing me, said, "This man has satisfied his own desire, having praised Menander, who is most to his taste and seems no longer to care about anything else. Many of the entertainments remain unexamined by us, about which I should be glad to hear you speak. And we shall judge the contest of the animal carvers tomorrow, if it please our guest and Diogenianus, while sober." "Well then," I said, "there are certain mimes, of which some are called plots and others farces. And I think neither kind is suited to a symposium. The plots, because of the length of the pieces and the difficulty of staging them, and the farces, being full of buffoonery and vulgar scurrility, are not fit to be watched even by the slave boys who carry the sandals, at least if their masters are sensible men. Yet most people, even with women reclining beside them and young children present, put on display representations of deeds and words, which disturb the soul more than any drunkenness. But the lyre, at any rate, has long been, even as far back as Homer's time, a familiar accompaniment of the feast, and it is not fitting to dissolve so ancient a friendship and intimacy. Rather, one need only ask the lyre singers to remove the excessive dirges and lamentation from their songs, and sing instead things auspicious and fitting for men at a festive gathering. As for the flute, it is not possible to banish it from the table even if one wished to, for the libations long for it together with the garland, and the divine joins its voice with the paean, and then it strikes up, and pass through the ears, pouring in a sweet sound that brought calm all the way to the soul, so that if the strong wine had not shaken loose or dissolved some troublesome and anxious thought, this, yielding to the grace and gentleness of the melody, grows quiet, provided that the music itself keeps due measure, without working the hearers into passion, or, with its droning pipes and many-stringed excess, unsettling and driving out of place a mind already made pliant by wine and unsteady. For just as grazing animals do not understand speech that carries meaning, but herdsmen rouse them and lull them again with careless hisses and clicks of the tongue, or with pipes and shells, so too whatever is bestial and herd-like in the soul, unintelligent and deaf to reason, is soothed and calmed by those who play and pipe to it with melodies and rhythms. Nevertheless, if I must say what I myself think, I would never hand the symposium over to the pipe alone, or to the melody of the lyre without speech and song, as though letting it be swept along by a mere current. We must train ourselves, both in our serious moments and in our play, to derive our pleasures from reasoned speech and to spend our time in conversation. And melody and rhythm should be served up like a relish alongside speech, not offered on their own account, nor should we indulge them like gluttons. For just as no one rejects the pleasure that accompanies wine and food along with the need for nourishment, while Socrates used to box the ears of that pleasure which comes from perfumes, as unnecessary and superfluous, so too, when the sound of the harp and the pipe merely strikes the ears on its own account, we should not give it entry. But if it follows along with speech and song, feasting and delighting the reason within us, then let us admit it, recalling that Marsyas was punished by the god precisely because, having stopped his own mouth with the strap and the pipes, he dared to compete with bare melody against song accompanied by the lyre. "Let us only take care," I said, "that to fellow drinkers capable of delighting one another through conversation and philosophy, we do not bring in anything from outside that will be more a hindrance to good company than any form of entertainment. For it is not only those who, having safety at home and from their own resources, still wish to import it from elsewhere, as Euripides said, who are foolish, but also those who, though great cheerfulness and good spirits are already present among them, make it a point of pride to bring in pleasures from outside. Indeed, the munificence of the great king, shown toward Antalcidas the Spartan, appeared strikingly tasteless and boorish, when he dipped a garland of mingled roses and crocus in perfume and sent it to him, thereby quenching its natural, proper beauty and doing outrage to the flowers. It is much the same thing, when a symposium has its own charm and its own proper music within it, to pipe and play upon it from outside, taking away what belongs to it by adding what is foreign. Indeed, the occasion most calling for hired performers would be when the symposium is heaving and bristling toward quarrel or contentiousness, so as to quench some abusive exchange and to interrupt an inquiry that is being carried into an unpleasant rivalry and a sophistical contest, and to check disputes proper to the assembly and the marketplace, until the symposium once again becomes, from the start, calm and unruffled. There was talk over dinner, while Nicostratus was our host, about the matters the Athenians were about to debate in assembly, when someone said, "Gentlemen, we are doing a Persian thing, deliberating over wine." Glaucias took him up and said, "Why more Persian than Greek?" For it was a Greek who said, "Counsel and cunning are better on a full stomach." And it was Greeks who, together with Agamemnon, besieged Troy, men to whom, once they had eaten and drunk, the old man would first begin to weave his counsel, becoming the one who proposed to the king the best course, saying, "Give a feast to the elders, for," he says, "you will obey him who, when many are gathered, devises the best counsel." For this reason, too, the peoples who enjoyed the best-ordered constitutions in Greece and clung most closely to their ancient customs kept their governing bodies together over wine. For the institutions called among the Cretans the Andria and among the Spartans the Phytisia held the rank of secret deliberative councils and aristocratic assemblies, just as, I think, do our own Prytaneum and the Smothetaean here. And not far removed from these is Plato's nocturnal assembly of the best and most statesmanlike men, to which the greatest matters, most worthy of consideration, are referred. And those who pour a last libation to Hermes when they are about to remember bed, do they not thereby bring reason's speech together with wine into the same place? At any rate, as though the wisest of gods were present and watching over them, men pray to him as they are first departing. And the ancients of old, as though Dionysus himself needed no help from Hermes, called him Eubuleus, good counselor, and for his sake called the night itself Euphron, the kindly minded. When Glaucias had gone through all this, it seemed to us that those turbulent debates had been fairly well lulled to sleep. And, so that they might be still further forgotten, Nicostratus introduced another inquiry, saying that at first he had not much cared about the practice, since it seemed to him a Persian one. But now that it had been shown to be Greek, he needed an argument to help him against the absurdity that appeared on the face of it. For reasoning, like an eye in a fluid that is being tossed about, becomes hard for us to move and hard to put to work. And the passions, from every side, like reptiles stirring toward the sun, are set in motion toward wine, and rising up, make the judgment unsteady and unsettled. Hence, just as reclining is better for drinkers than sitting, because it holds the body still and releases it from all motion, so it is best for the soul, too, to remain undisturbed. And if that is not possible, then, just as to children who cannot keep still one gives not a spear and sword but a rattle and a ball, so the god gave the wand of fennel to those who are drunk, put into their hands the lightest of weapons and the softest of defenses, so that, however quickly they strike, they do the least harm. For the mistakes of drunken men ought to be laughable, not pitiable and tragic, involving great failures. Moreover, and this is the most important point in deliberations about the weightiest matters, wine takes away from drunken men the very thing that a person lacking judgment and inexperienced in affairs most needs: to follow those who think clearly and to listen to the experienced. Wine takes this away, so that Plato says its very name, oinos, arose because it makes drinkers think oistai they have sense. For no drinker, however much he may fancy himself distinguished or handsome or rich, fancies it so strongly as he fancies himself wise. That is why wine is so full of talk and fills men with untimely chatter and a domineering conceit, so that we are inclined not to listen but rather to be listened to, and to lead rather than to follow, as is fitting. But, he said, one could easily gather points for this side of the case, since they are obvious. What is needed is to hear the opposing arguments, whether some younger man or some older one is prepared to give them. Then our brother, quite craftily and in a sophist's manner, said, do you really think anyone could find the arguments the problem admits of on the spur of the present moment? And when Nicostratus firmly affirmed that he did think so, given so many lovers of learning and statesmen present, our friend smiled and said, then, do you think that you yourself could speak adequately to us about these matters, while holding that, because of wine, one is disqualified for practical and political deliberation? Or is this like supposing that a man who has been drinking sees well enough with his eyes, but mishears with his ears those who meet him and converse with him, yet hears precisely those who sing and pipe? For just as here it is more likely that the useful, rather than the merely elegant, attracts the attention of the senses, so it is with the mind as well. I should not be surprised if something subtle and philosophical escapes a man over wine, while, when his mind is drawn to practical deliberations, it is likely to grow concentrated and to pull itself together for clear thinking. Just as Philip at Chaeronea, though he was babbling a great deal in his drunkenness and making himself ridiculous, the moment word reached him concerning a truce and peace, composed his face, drew his brows together, and, driving off his rambling, unrestrained manner, gave the Athenians a very well-considered and sober answer. And yet drinking is a different thing from being drunk, and we think that those who are drunk enough to babble nonsense ought to go off and sleep it off, whereas, In the case of men who otherwise have good sense, but who continue drinking wine over an extended time, and drink it through, there is no need to fear that they will fail in judgment and lose their skill, seeing that dancers and lyre players perform no worse at symposia than in theaters. For skill, when present, keeps the body upright in its activities and moving safely along with it. And to many men, wine, functioning as an ally that lends boldness, adds not a repulsive or unmixed boldness, but one that is graceful and persuasive. Just as they say Aeschylus, too, composed his tragedies while drinking. And it is not, as Gorgias said, that one of his plays, The Seven Against Thebes, is full of Ares, but rather that all of them are full of Dionysus. For wine, being, in Plato's words, one that warms the soul together with the body, makes the body run freely and opens up passages for imaginative ideas, which come streaming in along with the boldness of speech. For some men, who have an inventive nature but, while sober, one that is timid and rigid when they come to drinking, are made to give off vapor, like frankincense, through the warmth. And wine drives away fear, which is no less an obstacle than anything else to men deliberating, and extinguishes many of the other passions that are mean-spirited and ignoble. And it unfolds, as it were, certain folds of malice and festering resentment hidden in the soul, and brings every character and passion into full view in speech. It is, moreover, most productive of frankness, and, through frankness, of truth itself. And where frankness is absent, neither experience nor quickness of mind is of any use. In fact, many men succeed better by using whatever thought presents itself than if they craftily and cunningly conceal what occurs to them. There is, then, no need to fear that wine stirs up the passions, for what it stirs is not the basest part, except in the most wicked men, whose faculty of deliberation is never sober in any case. Rather, just as Theophrastus used to call barbershops wineless symposia because of their chatter, so too a wineless drunkenness, and a sullen one, dwells forever in the souls of the uneducated, forever disturbed by some anger or ill will or contentiousness or meanness of spirit. All of which wine, for the most part, blunts rather than sharpens, making men not foolish or stupid, but simple and free of cunning, men who do not overlook their own advantage, but who choose the honorable course. Those, however, who consider cunning to be cleverness, and false opinion and meanness of spirit to be prudence, naturally declare foolish those who, over wine, state plainly and without guile what appears to them. The ancients, on the contrary, called the god Eleutherius, the liberator, and Lysios, the loosener, and believed him to possess a great share of the prophetic art, not because of his bacchic frenzy and madness, as Euripides put it, but because, by removing and freeing the soul from its servility, its excessive fearfulness, and its distrust, he grants men the ability to deal with one another in truth and frankness. Those, Sosius Senecio, who banish philosophy from symposia, do not do the same thing as those who take away the light, but worse, inasmuch as, when the lamp is removed, moderate and self-controlled men will be no worse off, since their sense of shame counts for more with them than their seeing one another. But when ignorance and lack of culture are present along with wine, not even that golden lamp of Athena could furnish a graceful and orderly drinking party. To gorge oneself with others in silence is altogether swinish, and perhaps impossible. And the man who abandons reasoned speech at a symposium, but will not permit its being used in an orderly and beneficial way, is far more absurd than a man who thinks the guests at his dinner ought to drink and eat, but who pours them undiluted wine and sets before them relishes that are unseasoned and unprepared. For no drink and no food is as unpleasant and harmful, when not prepared in the proper manner, as speech that is passed around a symposium untimely and thoughtlessly. Philosophers who denounce drunkenness call it wine babble. And to babble is nothing other than to indulge in empty and nonsensical talk. And when disorderly chatter and nonsense fall into undiluted wine, insolence and drunken outrage are the most tasteless and graceless result. It is not without point, then, that among us too, at the Agrionia, the women search for Dionysus as though he had run away, then stop and say that he has taken refuge with the muses and is hidden among them. And a little later, when dinner is over, they pose riddles and puzzles to one another, the mystery rite teaching us that we must use, over drink, speech that has some element of contemplation and culture in it, and that when such speech is present alongside drunkenness, what is savage and frenzied is concealed, held down benignly by the muses. This book, then, contains, first, what we happened both to hear and to say last year at Plato's birthday celebration. It is the eighth book of the Table Talk. On the sixth day of the rising month of Thargelion, we had celebrated the birthday of Socrates, and on the seventh, we were celebrating that of Plato. And this occasion first provided us with talk suited to the coincidence, which Diogenes of Pergamum began. For he said that Ion had put it well concerning fortune, that though differing greatly from wisdom, it produces very many things resembling it. And this seemed to him to have brought about, quite artfully as if of its own accord, not merely that the two birthdays fall so close together, but also that the elder man and teacher should have come first in reputation. It occurred to me to mention to those present a good many other cases of coincidences that had converged on the same occasion, such as the matter concerning the birth and death of Euripides, born on the day on which the Greeks fought their sea battle against the Mede at Salamis, and dying on the day on which Dionysius the Elder, the tyrant in Sicily, was born. Fortune thus, as Timaeus said, at one and the same time leading off stage the imitator of tragic sufferings and bringing on stage the real performer of them. They also called to mind the death of Alexander the King and that of Diogenes the Cynic, which took place on the same day. And it was generally agreed that King Attalus had died on his own birthday, while as for Pompey the Great, some said he died on his birthday, others that he died in Egypt one day before his birthday. Pindar, too, came up for mention, since he had been born at the time of the Pythian Games and had furnished the god with many splendid hymns. And Flora said that Carnides, too, did not deserve to be left out of mention at Plato's birthday celebration, a man who was the most illustrious devotee of the academy. For both men, he said, were born at a festival of Apollo, the one at the Thargelia in Athens, the other while the Cyrenians were celebrating the Carnia, and both peoples keep their festival on the seventh day. And you, prophets and priests, he said, call the god, since he was born on that day, Hebdomagenes, seventh born. That is why those who attribute Plato's begetting to Apollo. And I do not think anyone would say that those who dedicate this offspring of Plato to Apollo are dishonoring the god, since through Socrates he has been made a physician for us, like another Chiron, for even greater sufferings and diseases. At the same time, he recalled the vision and voice said to have come to Ariston, Plato's father, in his sleep, forbidding him to have intercourse with his wife or touch her for 10 months. Tyndares the Spartan then took up the discussion and said, it is indeed fitting to sing and say of Plato that he did not seem to be the son of a mortal man, but of a god. For I am afraid that the notion of the divine may seem to conflict with what is incorruptible, in that the begetting is no less problematic than the begotten thing itself. For that too is a kind of change, and an experience of being acted upon, as Alexander himself, I think, suspected when he said that he recognized himself as most mortal and corruptible, especially in the act of intercourse with a woman and in sleep, on the grounds that sleep comes about through weakness, and that all generation is a passing away and corruption of something proper to oneself into something else. But I take heart again when I hear Plato himself calling the unbegotten and eternal God the father and maker of the cosmos and of all other begotten things. Not, of course, because they come into being through seed, but through some other power of the God which imparts to matter a generative principle, whereby matter is acted upon and changes, the God having implanted it. For the courses of the winds, too, escape the notice of the female bird, except when the moment of laying is at hand. And I think there is nothing strange in it, if the god, without approaching as a man does, but by certain other contacts through other means and touches, turns and fills the mortal with a more divine offspring. And the story is not my own, he said, but the Egyptians say that Apis too is engendered in this way, by the touch of the moon. And in general they attribute to a male god intercourse with a mortal woman, but they do not think, conversely, that a mortal man could furnish the beginning of conception and pregnancy to a female god, because they hold that the substances of the gods consist in air and breaths and certain kinds of heat and moisture. At this a silence fell, and then Diogenes began again and said, since we have had discussions about the gods, shall we, on the occasion of Plato's birthday, take up Plato himself as a partner in the conversation, by examining what notion he had in mind when he declared that God always does geometry, if indeed one ought to accept this saying as Plato's. When I had said that this is written nowhere clearly in any of his books, but has sufficient credibility and is characteristic of the Platonic manner, Tyndares immediately took up the point and said, "Do you suppose, Diogenianus, that the saying hints at something recondite and hard to discern, rather than exactly what he himself has often said and written in praise of geometry, namely that it draws us away from clinging to sense perception and turns us back toward the intelligible and eternal nature, the contemplation of which is the goal of philosophy, as it were the culminating vision of a mystery rite? For the nail of pleasure and pain, which fastens the soul to the body, seems to carry the greatest evil in this, that it makes the objects of sense more vivid than the objects of intellect, and forces the mind to judge by feeling rather than by reason. For growing accustomed through intense suffering and pleasure to attend to what wanders and shifts about the body, as though it were the truly existent, the mind is blinded, and it loses that organ and light of the soul which is worth 10,000 eyes, the only thing by which the divine can be beheld. Now in all the so-called branches of learning, as in mirrors that are unwarped and smooth, traces and images of the truth of intelligible things are reflected. But geometry especially, according to Philo, being the origin and mother city of the others, leads back and turns the mind, purifying and releasing it, as it were, gently from sense perception. That is why Plato himself found fault with the followers of Eudoxus, Archytas, and Menechmus for trying to reduce the doubling of the solid to instrumental and mechanical constructions, as though attempting, by means other than reason, to find two mean proportionals in whatever way was available. For in this way, he thought, the good of geometry is lost and destroyed, as it runs back again to the world of sense and is not carried upward, nor does it lay hold of the eternal and incorporeal images, in reference to which God is always God. After Tyndares, Florus, who was his companion and always liked to make a show, in jest, of being his admirer, said, "You have done the argument a service by making it not your own but common property, for you have given someone the chance to refute it by demonstrating that geometry is necessary not for the gods but for us. For God surely has no need of a branch of learning that serves like an instrument to turn and redirect the mind from things that come to be toward things that truly are. For those realities exist in him, and with him, and around him. But see whether Plato, in this hint, has escaped your notice as saying something relevant and proper to you, inasmuch as he blends Lycurgus with Socrates no less than with Pythagoras, as Dicaeochus thought. For Lycurgus, as you surely know, banished arithmetical proportion from Sparta as being democratic and mob-like, and introduced geometrical proportion instead, as suited to a temperate oligarchy and a lawful kingship. For the one assigns equality by number, the other what is fitting by ratio, and does not mix everything together indiscriminately. But there is in it a clear discrimination between the good and the bad, not by scales or by lots, but by allotting to each always what is proper to it, according to the difference of virtue and vice. This is the proportion that God applies to affairs, called, my dear Tyndares, justice and retribution, teaching us that the just is equitable, not that equality is just. For the equality that most people pursue, being the greatest of all injustices, God removes it as far as possible and preserves what is fitting, defining things geometrically according to reason and according to law. We applauded this. But Tyndares said Florus was being envious, and he called on Autobulus to take up the argument against Florus and chastise it. Autobulus declined to do that, but brought forward instead an opinion of his own. He said that geometry is a study of nothing else than the properties and modifications having to do with limits, and that God fashions the cosmos in no other way than by giving limit to matter, which is unlimited, not in size or number, but because the ancients were accustomed to call unlimited whatever is indefinite and unbounded on account of its disorder and irregularity. For shape and form are the limit of everything that has been shaped and formed, and matter, deprived of these, was in itself formless and shapeless. But when numbers and ratios came to be present in it, as though it were bound and encompassed by lines, and from lines by planes and depths, it furnished the first forms and differentiations of bodies, as it were foundations, for the generation of air and earth and water and fire. For it would have been impossible and impracticable for equalities of sides and similarities of angles and harmonious proportions to arise in octahedra and icosahedra, and further in pyramids and cubes, out of matter that is disordered and wandering, without something to set bounds to each thing and articulate it geometrically. Hence, once limit had come to be present in the unlimited, the universe was fitted together and blended in the best possible way and became, and continues to become, bounded. While matter is always forcing its way toward re-emerging into the indefinite and fleeing from being made subject to geometry, and reason lays hold of it and circumscribes it and distributes it into forms and differences, from which all growing things have derived their generation and constitution. When this had been said, they asked me too to contribute something to the discussion. I praised the opinions that had been expressed as genuine and proper to those who had put them forward, and said that they had sufficient plausibility. But, I said, so that you may not undervalue yourselves nor look entirely outside your own resources, listen to the argument on this subject most highly esteemed among our teachers. For among the most geometrical of theorems, or rather problems, is this: given two figures, to construct a third that is equal to the one and similar to the other. And it is said that upon discovering this, Pythagoras offered a sacrifice. For this is certainly far more elegant and more musical than that other theorem, which demonstrated that the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the squares on the sides about the right angle. You put it well, said Diogenes, but what has this to do with the argument? You will readily understand, I said, if you recall the division in the Timaeus, where he divided into three the primary things from which the cosmos derived its generation, of which we call the one God, by the most just of names, another matter and another form. Now matter is the most disordered of underlying things, form the most beautiful of paradigms, and God the best of causes. He wished, then, so far as was possible, to leave nothing that could be bounded unbounded, but to order nature by reason and number, making one thing out of all the underlying elements together, as much as form and as much as matter combined could produce. Hence, having set himself this problem, given two things, to make a third he made and makes, and forever preserves the cosmos, equal to matter and similar to form. For since it always exists in a state of generation and change and all manner of experiences, on account of the innate necessity of its bodily nature, it is aided by its father and maker through the reason that defines its being with reference to the paradigm. And the circumference of existing things is more beautiful than that which is merely proportionate. A commotion arose while we were dining at Athens at Ammonius's house, resounding through the residence, as people outside were shouting for the general, for Ammonius was serving his third term as general. When he had sent some of his attendants to quell the disturbance, and they had sent the men away, we ourselves began to inquire why those inside here, along with those shouting from outside, while those outside do not in the same way hear those inside. Ammonius said that this had already been resolved by Aristotle, that a voice from within, carried outward into the vast and open air, is immediately dimmed and dispersed, while a voice coming from outside inward suffers nothing of the kind, but is held together and remains distinct. But this other matter required more explanation: why voices are more resonant at night and preserve their clarity along with their volume more purely. To me, then, he said, it does not seem a poor contrivance of Providence to have furnished clarity for hearing at a time when sight has little or no work to do at all. For since the air is dark, according to Empedocles, of desolate, blind night, whatever it takes away from the eye's power of perceiving in advance, it restores through the ears. But since it is necessary also to track down the causes of things that come about of necessity by nature, and this too is proper to the natural philosopher, the study of material and instrumental principles, who among you, he said, will be the first to offer a plausible account? When silence followed, Boethus said that, when he was still young and playing the sophist, he used to employ postulates from geometry and take unproved hypotheses, but now he would use some of the propositions already demonstrated by Epicurus. Existing things move within what does not exist, for much void is scattered and mixed among the atoms of the air. Now, when the air is diffused and has breadth and circulation on account of its rarity, the empty spaces between its particles that are left are small and slight, and the atoms, being scattered about, occupy a large amount of space. But when it is contracted, and a compression of the atoms into a small space occurs, and they collide with one another under compulsion, they create much open space and large gaps outside themselves. This happens at night on account of the cold, for heat relaxes and separates and dissolves compressions. Hence things that boil and soften and melt occupy more room than their bodies did before. And conversely, things that congeal and cool contract toward one another and draw together and leave voids in the vessels that contain them and spaces from which they have withdrawn. Now the voice, when it advances and meets many bodies packed closely together, is either altogether blunted, or suffers great breaks and many collisions and delays. But in an empty space free of bodies, it has a smooth and continuous and unimpeded run to the ear, preserving its clarity together with its speed all the way with the sound. You see indeed that the empty parts of vessels, when struck, respond more readily to the blows and extend the sound far, and often, being carried round in a circle, transmit it widely. But a vessel filled with a solid body, or with some liquid altogether, becomes deaf and voiceless, since the sound has no road or space by which to pass through. Of the bodies themselves, gold and stone, on account of their density, produce thin and harsh sounds and quickly extinguish the notes within themselves. But bronze is sonorous and talkative, in that it is full of voids and light and thin in bulk, not compressed by many bodies pressing on one another, but possessing an abundant mixture of a yielding and impalpable substance, which gives it facility for its other motions as well, and receives the voice kindly and sends it on its way, until someone, laying hold of it as though along a road, arrests it and blinds the void, at which point it stops and ceases to advance further, on account of the obstruction. "These things," he said, "seem to me to make the night resonant, and the day less so, since the heat and diffusion of the air produce only small intervals between the atoms." "Let no one," he said, "raise objections to the first hypotheses." And I, at Ammonius's bidding to say something in reply to him, said, "Your first hypotheses, my dear Boethus, although they contain a great deal of void, may stand, but you are not right to posit void as what preserves and moves sound. For it is proper to silence and stillness to be untouched, unaffected, and unstruck, whereas voice is the striking of a resonant body, and resonant is what is sympathetic with itself and continuous in its own substance, and easily moved and light and uniform and responsive because of tension and continuity, such as is the air among us.